We'll just make her feel guilty about it. Okay. All right, let's start. Okay. So my name is Jean-Philippe Lebleu. Been a member of the Liberal Shoot Movement for a couple of years now. And we gather like every week, every Thursday we gather here, discuss about certain ideas that will help us change the situation right now, change this this economic crisis, this economic meltdown that started pretty much, well, let's say we've seen the death of the financial system about a year ago, but the system has been basically self-destructive since a couple of decades now already. What we're going to do tonight, people should not see that as just a like an information, how do you say, a seance, I guess. Session. Sure, there's going to be information. Hopefully, there's going to be some ideas, but what we have to do right now and what we're asking everyone to do is to organize with us on the basis that people should know there's a crisis right now, whether it's about the food or about the war or about the economy. The question is now, how are we going to organize? And our movement, the LaRouche movement, has put out this report about Mr. George Soros. And he's not good. He's your enemy. The thing is that when you go through that, it's very easy to see that George Soros is a very immoral person, but, I mean, there's, how many immoral people do we see every day? There's a reason why we have to pick on that guy, and it's an importance, not just on from the standpoint of, let's say, when you find some guy like an evil speculator, right, who's trying to get a lot of money, or someone who's stimulated only by his own personal greed. We're talking about a whole empire, right? The idea itself of imperialism, as LaRouche keeps stressing, and this is also something that we have to keep stressing, that the whole idea of an imperialism has not died, and was, and it still is, very present in politics. In also science, in art, in basically people's lives, and it's a dynamic which is dominating more and more, or has been dominating more and more, the more the financial crisis was occurring, and the more we would see effects or consequences of that financial crisis. But at the same time, LaRouche and the movement affiliated with him has been fighting to basically destroy this dynamic. And this dynamic is very important to understand, that if you think about all the nations put together, and if you change the rules, right, if you put imperialist rules, let's say, right, where the biggest wins, right, might is right, law of the jungle, well, as a nation, you're forced whether to play the role of an empire or to play the role of a colony. So we're not saying that, oh, the United States is a big, bad empire and they're going to destroy everything. That nations today, and also individuals, because nations are made by individuals, individuals are forced to behave in an imperial fashion in order to survive, or in order to just to make a living, or to be successful, or whatever. So what LaRouche has been pushing for, right, and we discussed about it in today's briefing, we get twice a daily update from our locals in Leesburg, Virginia, general update. And what was being stressed is this this authority that we have on the question of the empire, of knowing where the problem comes from, not just from a mechanistic standpoint, but from a historical standpoint. so that if you see an action coming from a nation, it does not necessarily mean that the cause of the actions paused, which is, let's say, a military intervention. It's not that this action really comes from the physical nation, like the United States, right? We've been documenting a lot the role of the British Empire through economic means, through military means, and through other means that we'll see with our good friend here, Mr. Soros, who, that's a question I wanted to ask, but first I'm just going to end my little parenthesis, is that since we know about this British Empire, I mean, we got to convey to people what this is exactly and how it works. But LaRouche, by proposing a solution to the crisis, which is to get Russia, China, and India in a powerful, very, very powerful dialogue with the United States for a new financial system, we have seen the actions of the so-called bad guys. By proposing something powerful, like let's change the whole financial system, you have a reaction coming from British circles or American circles led by British, it's a British brain, to prevent any change from happening. And the thing is that right now we're in a good position because you have one victory and a half, which is not bad. It's something that people didn't really hear about, is this about this Lisbon Treaty, right? Where in Europe they were trying to basically make this big, basically a big European empire, destroying the sovereignty of each nation and having this whole big European Union direction. Actually based in London, even people were proposing as a president of the European Union, they were proposing Tony Blair, which tells you a bit of the intention, Tony Blair being one of the main warmonger concerning Iraq and Afghanistan. The whole quest, you know, where in the world is Bin Laden? That was pretty much Tony Blair, right? So, but this treaty that people from financial circles and elsewhere try to really throw at Europeans, try to put it in their throat, was rejected by the Irish people through a referendum. Which means, so if one rejected it, then the whole treaty is canceled. So it was canceled by the vote of a lot of people from the 80% of the lower bracket, poor people, the workers. And it's a big victory, but it's not the end of obviously the fight. Already now you have still people trying to promote different other ways to have some type of European empire through, for example, and that's something we're going to go back on, through a moralistic humanitarian military intervention. Right? You heard these people saying, like in Canada, we have a Michael Ignatieff, who is a liberal, but he's also he was a Harvard teacher, worked for the BBC, and is one of those humanistic invader. Right, I'm going to invade you for your own sake, and whatever happens is going to be your fault. But you have, for example, there's something that they tried that Europe, especially London, tried. They tried to create an intervention in Myanmar. Remember, people have seen the. I think there was a tornado or a hurricane, but Myanmar was like completely destroyed. And the European press started attacking Myanmar, saying government is corrupt. They don't bring the food where it should be. People are dying. Myanmar should be a regime change, right? So the same.
They were saying they were keeping out people who wanted to. People who wanted to offer aid. Saying like they were keeping them out. They weren't letting them in.
Yeah, and the problem that Myanmar was facing is that. Yeah, well, there was a reason why they would prevent those guests from coming in. It's because there was this talk about regime change at the same time. And knowing these powers, these forces, Myanmar said, no, we don't want you guys' help. So they opened the doors to the other Asian nations, who then went there and helped and fixed the problem. but also identify that there was no problem at the source. This was all a lie. And you get the same thing going on now with Zimbabwe, with the elections. The opposition to Mugabe canceled his running. He says, I'm leaving. And it's not the first time he does that. He's done that before. Just to create a problem and to just, leave the election and then call for an outside intervention in Zimbabwe. And that's something that we see also with George Soros, but we're going to get back into that. But the thing is, right, if we, so we get our first victory with Ireland, pushing back the Lisbon Treaty, which is basically an imperialist treaty. And we got, for example, we have the second victory, or victory and a half, when Russia called for a new financial system, which is not, when Russia talks, it usually have reverberations. It's very important that they call as well for a new financial system, like others did before, but then when Russia kicks in, that's important. But what makes it a victory and a half is the fact, and that's what LaRouche, that was LaRouche's reaction to the call by the president. He says, okay, it's very nice you call for a new financial system, but everything that you have identified as a solution is not a solution. So Russia, China, and India, that we should see now as a very as a political bloc, and you get one of the main guy, representative, Russia, calling for a new financial system, but still, although they know in great part who their enemy really is, right? That they are dealing with British. When I say British, it's not like it's not really like the British nation, but it's a British apparatus in Great Britain, which is mainly financial and imperial, coming from the British East India Company, right, and using the government of Britain for doing whatever they want to do. So the Russians, knowing their enemy, still hasn't been able to realize that what they were proposing for themselves as a solution still represented the same flaws that the actual system has. So if you want to change the system and to replace it by the same thing, it doesn't work. Unless you re-spin things up, but what they're proposed to themselves, and that triggered LaRouche to write a paper, which is called The Economics Debate in Russia. It's not a paper which is finished yet, but he goes into the fight over economics in Russia, but since a long time, not just since a couple of weeks, but since pretty much the 19th century. And Russia was was more than a big political player at the time, and they saw what LaRouche calls the American system of political economy, right? They saw the economic revolution at the time of Abraham Lincoln, especially in the 1876 when you had the Centennial Exhibition, where many nations, but especially the United States, exposed their industrial, scientific, economic potential to the whole world, which brought people like Dmitri Mendeleev. People might remember the periodic table. So the guy who figured out the periodic table was also an advisor to the Tsar at the time. And he helped bring in the construction of the Siberian, the Trans-Siberian Railroad. Yeah. So Russia had a certain link with the United States based on this economic system, this economic approach, which became a bit more confused when communism started to kick in Russia and throughout the world. Where, it's funny because we read this, people were here or there? No. You were there when we read Schiller? Yeah, you were.
Oh, yeah, the electric furnace?
Yeah. And what communism basically brought, I don't want to go through too much of that, but there's something about what we're proposing and what worked in history, which has to do with your the way you see human beings and the way you see society, right? For example, I'm going to ask you a couple of questions. What do people think when they think about an immoral person? If I ask you, name me like the problems of an immoral person, what do they do? What do they think? People have an idea? Like immoral. You see someone said, this is the immoral person, what does that person do?
They're selfish.
Okay. I write them down. Selfish? Care.
Or just rather inconsiderate.
Well, yeah, I sort of thinking about that, the idea of not thinking about others.
Yeah, well, that's pretty much what we're underlying here.
And
underlining.
Basically, just act upon instinct.
And conceited.
How do you mean that? Like,
conceded.
The instinct to do something different.
Well, you have an action. You can think about or judge what is the best approach.
No,
you
just
follow your instincts and keep that feeling.
It's sort of like what feels good.
But yeah, like an animal.
Okay.
Because you don't do the moral act of thinking. You just judge.
See with whatever option makes you feel best. Like.
Yeah.
Are we behaving immorally?
I think we're all judging the immoral person right now, or our preconception of what an immoral person
is.
Anyway.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's not that clear. If you look into the domain of science, then there's more medicine, then you'll see that it's a vast subject, the immorality. Because, well, people have other things.
We're saying judgment could be immoral, judgment?
No, he just made a comment on the fact that people making judgments could be a description of an immoral person, but I said everyone makes judgments, and actually even going back to an immoral person.
No, that's not what I said. No,
okay.
No, he said making your judgment based upon what feels best, like what makes you feel good, without thinking through, like a constant. Like making a judgment call based upon.
Yeah, just for me and
you and I.
Okay, good. For you. Would you like?
Yeah, what's it?
It's four.
Again? Is that?
Okay.
It's pretty much.
Probably make it look bigger.
Well, there might be some of the things like torturing little kids or pulling their nose hairs.
But you want to think, I think, like, you want to think of your average Joe, like your average baby boomer, you know, that's not necessarily an evil person, but that's just immoral.
What?
What?
Like they have all the good intentions in the world, but they just...
Yeah, I mean, rather than go after, like, all the qualities of, like, a torturer and, you know, because... It comes across when you meet your average person that has a family and that is otherwise, you know, you think is a good person, but when you get to know them, they're just, you know, they're sophists. that's what it is, because they don't, you know, they don't really care about others, and they maybe deep down might have a little idea that what they're doing is not right, it's not good for someone else, but since they're benefiting, then.
Are they going to care for you until you restart bothering them?
Just that they follow their own profit, не importă ce способ или зотра.
Yeah, it's pretty much selfish.
Well, they just don't care about doing things that are wrong, you know, or they'll sophisticatedly try to make it water down like it's not that bad, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, an immoral person, you know, at the start, because he's not amoral, he's immoral, so he knows what is good and bad.
Uh-huh.
He just acts upon, he just knows it and still acts upon being whatever, you know. But an amoral person just doesn't feel anything. Doesn't know what, he just clean slate without even good or bad. There's no morals in there. But an immoral person does have a sense of what is good and what is bad.
This might sound like a cliche and all, but philosophically we can't really judge what's moral and moral, what's right and wrong, because it depends on who we are and how we're brought up and things like that. So.
Oh, okay, but that. Then would you say that there are immoral actions? You say that there would not be immoral actions?
Right. It depends on my situation, where the point of view I see it could be immoral, but just some other person's point of view is immoral. Unless we can't really say something's immoral or
okay.
Everyone
has to agree on. If you do something that's good for you but bad for others, how would you call it? Good or bad?
By
their definition, and what they grew up in, it's not immoral.
Okay, well,
it might be immoral if you eat your the persons from your own society. So,
no, but for example, animals over, like if you care, some person is bad for immoral, problematic, or like Jewish heritage.
Well, let me. Well, let me give you a quote of Soros, because this quote is what you know, because George Soros was a Hungarian, well, he's still alive, he's a Hungarian Jew, so, and he experienced Nazi Germany, right? First seats. And here's what his father tells him when the Nazis kicks in. And that's a paraphrasing, but that's him. That's George Soros. He says.
Was it an interview?
Yeah, there was an interview on TV, WNET, that was 93. So he says, when the Germans came in Hungary, my father said, quote, "This is a lawless occupation. The normal rules don't apply. You have to forget how you behave in a normal society. This is an abnormal society." End of quote. Then Soros continued, "And he arranged for all of us to have false papers. Everybody had a different arrangement. I was adopted by an official of the Minister of Agriculture, whose job was to take off Jewish properties. So I actually went with him, and we took possession of the larger estates. That was my identity. So it's strange, very strange life. I was 15 years old at the time." And then, then this other quote by his father, who says, his father is Tivadar Soros, and he says, "As pseudo-Christians, we had not quite reached that level of Christianity where we were willing to return bread for stones." Right? Christians turn the other cheek. Not now, at least. Not see. There's a change in society, which is a very big, powerful change. Right, Nazis comes in and they're gonna actually kill people, and everyone knows it. So his father says, "Okay, forget whatever you were taught at school or at the synagogue. That just don't work." And what happened is that then Soros starts taking those Jewish properties, being part of a Nazi department. It was called, was actually the Nazi economic department in Hungary. So Soros is 14 years old, and already he says, he starts picking Jewish properties, right? The Nazis are there killing people. And he says, well, that was my identity. So he develops himself as a young man in such a situation. So probably if you ask this guy about, you'd probably say, well, look, you know, you do what you gotta do, right? And there's some other quotes, but just to keep it on that. Well, Val also said something which is interesting, because, and maybe people through their daily lives or through, I know that myself, through organizing, we tend sometimes to see a lot of immorality, in a sense, because we're saying that there's a way you can know if something is moral or immoral. And LaRouche demonstrated that through economics, right? Instead of just looking at numbers, whatnot, there's a physical, there's an action, a human action, that will develop the potential of human beings, and there is other type of action that would just bring society to down to its knee, right? And because the thing that Schiller mentioned in his document that we read last time on the he wrote a document on history on two different societies, one from the society of Sparta with Lycurgus, and the other one Athens with Solon of Athens as the leader. And one thing he identifies as a big difference is this question of morality. That Sparta, people have heard about the big movie 300, right? This guy is Sparta. They all, right? They're killers, and they're born to be killers. And Schiller illustrates, you know, these mothers that they see their son coming back from war, and they're actually sad that he didn't die for the fatherland, right? And you're like, and Schiller goes, well, that's everything but motherly love. You know, you're back, right? Coward.
No, you sleep on the couch.
Shut up.
Well, I killed everybody.
See,
why
so.
Why didn't you learn from your brothers?
Yeah, and yet those other mothers going to see the, the church or
the
whatever,
temple.
The temple, and they would go and they would say, ah, so happy my son died for the fatherland. So the state, or the idea of the state, which is rather empty, was what was defended by Sparta, but it was complete immorality. There was no, every human relationship, like mother, the son, because the children would belong to the state. Right, so your father is a state, which is this thing. People were treated like, you know, when you were a young man, you had to actually, if you want to have a full, like your threefold meal, if you want to be fed during the day, you were served some food, but the rest you had to steal it. And if you were caught stealing, oh man, you'd remember it. It would actually be strong punishment to make you a good robber, and to perform, you know, in military service, you know, military actions. So Schiller brings this question of morality, which is what develops human beings. You know, what, for example, why would Russia, China, and India join together? I mean, they don't have to, and they could say, oh man, I don't want to trust the Chinese. You know, they're a bit sneaky, so or to pull back and do. I'll do it on my own, right? I'll just do it myself. And, you know, it's a lot of jungle. If I don't protect myself against the British, they're gonna get me. So I better protect myself, right? So. And, in medicine, the interesting thing, people can look into that later, but there's actually a name. There's a name for that as a disease, to be immoral, and it's being a sociopath. Now they change the name. They make it like this. Well, not that long, but it's a longer name to be like. I forget the term, but it's a different term. It's not anymore sociopath, but it's still the same problem where you actually really don't care about whatever happens to other people. You actually manage to block a bit like, as we'll see, Mr. Soros fits into that. Also a lot of young kids playing video games, right? Losing attachment to reality through fantasy land or whatnot. And also that it's, what they were mentioning in the book is that it's very hard to cure that disease, because the person who is affected by it will tend to blame society most for everything that's happening. So they never look for a cure. The problem is always society. And good thing for us, Mr. Soros wants to change society. It's just that, I mean, he has his own idea, I guess, but we'll see. We'll try to see what it really means. I wanted people to have a copy. I didn't prepare any slide or whatever, but there's a couple of quotes. Oh, excuse me. Because what I wanted to do, the thing you want to look at is Soros, like when you look at a play like Hamlet, you don't want to just look at Hamlet per se. This is a big mistake that dramatists and actors are doing, right? If an actor is remembered for his role in Hamlet, for example, you know, like Oscar winners, right? Like most Oscar winners today are going to win prize when they play crazy people. And you have Rain Man, you know, an Oscar, or Forrest Gump, you know. Right? You're being a bit crazy. Or Jack Nicholson, the Joker, or whatever. But in drama, you want to be able to give a sense to people where lies the tragedy. And like when you look at Hamlet, for example, you don't want to just look at this guy as being a complete existentialist, behaving like a teenager. But you want to look at where does this flaw lie in the population itself. That's why at the beginning Shakespeare brings this idea of the ghosts, that people are seeing ghosts. There's something rotten in the kingdom of Denmark. So it's not just a question of one guy. And same thing with Mr. Soros. It would be a mistake for us to approach it just from the standpoint of Soros per se. Because Soros is he's not only a man, but his development is also has been caused by something. He's been part of something. And when we're going to look at his morality, his immorality or amorality or relative morality, depending, we also have to look at society's immorality or amorality or lack of both or whatever. Because that's the role that we have to look into. There's a need for a change in our society. There are options being put on the table, and we're going to need people to look into those alternatives, and how we're going to bring these things about through organizing the population, who, as Valérie hypothesized, that immorality at a certain point might become average. That, yeah. Whether it's willful or not, we don't know. But, yeah, that what we see in one individual, or in the head of state, or whatever, can actually be the consequence of a degenerating society. Right? because we haven't been looking at Soros from the standpoint of his bad actions necessarily, because there's a plenty of people that you could make a dossier on and demonstrate how crazy they are or how immoral they are, and you don't have to necessarily go too far. The thing is that we made a dossier on George Soros because we qualify him as what's called a British agent or British imperial agent, meaning that someone is being used or is willfully being used as a bringer of change, but more like bringer of chaos and bringer of this imperial doctrine, this imperial dynamic that I was talking about earlier. Because this is what LaRouche is saying to those guys in Russia. He's saying, you guys have identified a problem, but still, you guys haven't been able to identify the solution to all this crisis. And the more this crisis is being present, the more people like Soros, their role will be more and more important, unless we really break them at the source and cut their legs before they grow too much. Okay. Questions so far? Or I think it's okay. Okay. So there was a. Why don't we just stick? People should look at page 3. Okay. Where you see like there's an interview. So let's just read that. It's very short.
From the beginning of the interview, or?
Well, it says George Soros was confronted
yeah.
with such images. So you want to be a Croft?
Sure.
I guess when they say voiceover, this was a TV show in '98. Voiceover is, I guess, as you don't see the guy, they're showing images. You're gonna see they'll be showing images. So you want to be Croft?
Yep, sure. You want to start?
Yeah. Okay, I'll do Soros for now.
Okay. These are pictures from 1944 of what happened to George Soros' friends and neighbors. You're a Hungarian Jew.
Mm-hmm.
Who escaped the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
By posing as a Christian.
Right.
And you watched lots of people get shipped off to death camps.
Right. I was 14 years old. And I would say that that's when my character was made.
In what way?
That one should think ahead. One should understand and anticipate events and when one is threatened. It was a tremendous threat of evil. I mean, it was a very personal experience of evil.
My understanding is that you went out with this protector of yours, who swore that you were his adopted godson.
Yes, yes.
Went out, in fact, and helped in the confiscation of property from the Jews.
Yes, that's right.
I mean, that sounds like an experience that would send lots of people to the psychiatric couch for many, many years. Was it difficult?
No, not at all. Not at all. Maybe as a child you don't see the connection. But it created no problem at all.
No feeling of guilt?
Nope.
For example, that I'm Jewish and here I am watching these people go. I could just as easily be there. I should be there. None of that?
Well, of course, I could be on the other side, or I could be the one from whom the thing is being taken away. But there was no sense that I shouldn't be there, because that was, well, actually, in a funny way, it's just like in markets, that if I weren't there, of course I wasn't doing it, but somebody else would be taking it away anyhow. And it was whether I was there or not, I was only a spectator. The property was being taken away, so I had no role in taking away that property, so I had no sense of guilt. Okay, so when we think, like in the 50s, mainly the 40s, the American military was trying to, after the results of World War II, which was that they had won, but there was a faction of the military that was looking at the results in terms of the casualties. And they looked at it and they said, well, U.S. soldiers per capita weren't that good at killing people. Because, you know, if you send a bunch of farmers to war, they're not going to start craving for blood. They're farmers and they're being shipped to protect their nation, but they're not going to start acting like Rambo all of a sudden. There's a moral barrier, right? People would actually whether shoot in the air or shoot people where they know they wouldn't kill them. So you have some people starting to look at how we can desensitize soldiers to make them quote unquote more efficient. And one of the big thing, it's also something that Pascal showed in his class on art, but you can actually desensitize someone to the point that their actions being very immoral or even dangerous for the sake of people's lives, because we know that economists or financiers have that power, but that there's no connection whatsoever. That the, as George Soros put it, right, if it had not been me, well, someone else would have done it. So, because someone else would have done it anyway, I don't feel any guilt. If it had been me, it would have been someone else. Big deal. But
he's talking about an experience he had when he was a teenager, and not
yeah.
Performed in circumstances that he had no control over. I'm not sure what the point what are you trying to bring as a point?
He's talking
now
about
the situation he was 14.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then he says, and I would say that that's when my character was made, for example.
Yeah.
Right? Or that he said something similar to that.
Well, it shows that he's a
moral
person because his own people.
No, he's saying that he didn't experience guilt at the age of 14 in a circumstance over which he had no control. I'm not sure that.
He says
that
he didn't experience guilt even after.
Yeah.
So about his situation where.
I
disagree.
Okay. Let's say that at 14 you don't know what good and evil is. Later,
not
you know.
Asking him whether who was good and evil. They were asking him at the time whether or not he felt guilt over a situation under which he didn't really have.
Not quite.
His perception of what that meant.
In my opinion, the reporter says that experience should brought you on the couch of psychiatrists for years. So years after the experience.
That's what the reporter is saying, that he thinks it should have brought him onto a psychiatric couch. That's his perception
of what it should be. I feel no guilt even
now. Yeah, because
guilt at that situation has been brought from place to place.
Well, if you don't know what's right and wrong at one time, but later on you figure out what's right and wrong.
That doesn't mean I would have guilt over a situation I had no control.
After a situation you've done some bad things?
He didn't do anything.
No, but the guy helped people take the property of his own people.
I understand the situation.
And I would feel guilty at eight, or anybody would feel guilty. If my people were...
I disagree with you.
It's
okay.
It's just the characterization of him being a sociopath, and the definition which is accepted is that he feels no regard for the outcome of other human beings' lives.
I'm not sure that I read the same thing. The fact that
experience shaped his future worldview, and something like that is such a position of power.
I can accept more that it's part of just like everybody's life. What you experience helps to create what your worldview is. I'm just saying that here, he's saying he experienced no guilt over a situation for which he was put in without control of his own,
mm-hmm.
And that even later he says, well, I experienced no guilt at that position because I didn't do anything wrong in that position. He was put in a situation to accompany people who were doing something as far as taking away.
What's your name again? Sorry.
Hun.
Okay.
Well, she said she was put in a situation so he had to protect himself, and the only way of protecting himself is to help the stronger to be on the minor side.
Okay. I think.
Learn to later feel sorry or feel sorrow for a situation later, but not necessarily feel experience guilt for having participated in
But there's
your own people. Yes.
There are two things in there. There are two things, because you could say yes, he was a kid, and you know, pretend to be a Christian or go become, you know, a bar of soap. But I think the argument, which is not a complete argument for it, but what I'm trying to do is to give a sense to people of who this guy really is. And to say, okay, I had no guilt whatsoever, okay, you could say that, but when you look at especially the last quote, because he has an argument saying, well, here's why I didn't feel any guilt, and we're going to actually see something more and more coming in other quotes, because you know, it's like with Schwarzenegger, right? His father was a Nazi, but if that's the only argument you have, it's still a bit shallow, right? So, but when he says that, it's cut off a bit, but he says, well, actually, in a funny way, it's just like in markets. So we're gonna see that if I weren't there, of course, I wasn't doing it, but someone else would be taking it away anyhow. Because that's the thing, right? Since Hun brought it, says, well, how do you know if something is really moral or immoral? Right? That, you know, it can depend on who you are, or, I mean, we're being a bit more straightforward on that question, but we can take, we're going to let it flow. But that's the thing, right? How do you justify your action? There are different ways. And when you say, well, if I had not done it, someone else would. Mm-hmm. If I hadn't speculated on the Italian lira and destroyed the lira in 94, probably someone else would have. If I didn't kill that guy, you know, I'm exaggerating, but...
I'm not talking about that aspect either. I was specifically talking about...
Okay, but do you see... Yeah, but do you see what the point I'm emphasizing is, that little quote?
I asked you what the point, thing I started with, what would your point be?
Yeah, so we have a way to justify things, because if a society is collapsing, right, and that's what LaRouche keeps bringing about, we have to be able to identify a proper trends of action versus a one which is flawed. And for an empire, right, where we could, just from the standpoint of history, look at empires as doing a terrible harm through slave labor or whatnot, you also have to ask yourselves, well, what type of individuals would actually do their dirty work, right? Which is the reason for that dossier, right? The United States right now are caught with fighting the British Empire through interventions in their own nation with people like Soros. Okay, but Soros will keep living, and maybe not the first time, but in the 19th. Oh, sorry.
For me, I think the same way, that the point that he's trying to make is that in any competent economist, any competent person who's analyzing the method that goes about the kind of actions that are taking place in Wall Street is sociopathic and it's quasi-criminal. The fact is that the same experience that he had, the same explanation for why he didn't feel any guilt, you'll find the same kind of mentality from, you know, somebody in a very poor neighborhood who felt forced to do very horrible acts, selling drugs, killing, raping, etc. The same kind of mentality. Now, the question is, okay, whether he's inherently evil because he's forced in that position. The question is, we want somebody who has that twisted worldview, due to an experience that, regardless if it's not his, whether it was not his choice or not to be in that position, the fact that you have somebody with that twisted worldview in such a powerful position, such an influential capacity over entire nations and their markets. And this is the real issue here, is that it's this kind of mentality that's driving our economic and financial policies. Thus, when you have speculation on food and you say, well, let the markets take care of it, it's sociopathic to say that. Why? Because a billion people are on the brink of starvation. And food is not, it's not a product.
What are you trying to tell me? That I'm misunderstanding or misunderstanding?
Well, no, no. The whole point to show that is
you're extrapolating to something else that I didn't comment on.
Well,
I've commented on a particular item, which I disagree with the opinion, but that's fine. But I'm not talking about whether or not I think the markets, reasonable to say that an excuse for an action.
I understand exactly what you're saying. I'm just saying that's why we're extrapolating. Because it's not to say that it was his fault and that he was born an evil person. The fact that he's not a nice guy. And the fact that he would go and justify that kind of action and himself extrapolating that to how the markets were.
Don't think
they're intrinsically linked. And the fact that they continue.
Let's look at the other part, because Soros will become a big financier, speculator. And he's first being given his money from the hands of people working with the Rothschild. What's his name? A baron, obviously. Edmund of Rothschild. Which I think is the same Rothschild that was with Schwarzenegger, when Schwarzenegger, before he became governor of California. There was a meeting with Schwarzenegger, Warren Buffett, and Edmond Rothschild. Yeah. So his fund, the first thing that his fund is being used for is speculation on money, meaning that through different, not tricks, but different mechanical means. If you have a lot of money, you're able to actually create big-time ruckus in terms of the finance or the monetary aspect of nations. And one big thing he was known for, and it was actually being persecuted against, was the speculation on basically in Europe, especially the Italian lira. And let's have another quote, and then we'll see what exactly he's thinking. Page 5, the paragraph before Project Death, in the middle it says, I'm sure, he's basically commenting, the London Guardian after he did speculate on the what's called the ERM, which is the European rate mechanism, which is basically a protectionist tool or an institution to actually create a certain cohesiveness among the currencies in Europe. Right. Then he says the following, I'm sure speculative actions have had some negative consequences. But that does not enter my thinking at all. It cannot. If I abstain from certain actions because of moral doubts, then I would cease to be an effective speculator. I have not even a shadow of remorse for making a profit. He continues, I did it only to make money. There's a bunch of quotes, but well, I think what we have to look at from that standpoint is, right, if you want to be a good speculator, you put morality beside and you actually can become successful. So do people agree with that? I erased it, but maybe people wouldn't have any problem with that. Okay, if you're moral, you don't speculate on old grandmother's pension fund. I can't do that for them. Or you can make a killing. Then double sense of the meaning. What?
Maybe you could elaborate quickly on what speculation is. I don't know if everyone here understands that.
Well, I'll give an example that Soros did, and I'm going to come back to it. But, for example, he did a killing a lot of money with buying shares of Halliburton, right, famous company, which were like at I think they were like at $20-something.
You have to talk about what he did before that.
Yeah, I want to keep it later, but yeah, there's this movement called MoveOn.org, which is a movement that he's controlling now, which is a leftist group who had a big campaign against Halliburton, right? Halliburton, the war profiteering, etc. So the share went from like very high to very low, like basically lost around 50% of its value. So then Soros bought something like 2 million of those shares and basically told MoveOn.org to shut up, otherwise they wouldn't get any money. So the share went up back to its normal price, and then so he made a couple of million with that. His position? Well, he's the head of a couple of funds, like quantum funds or different, also different NGO. He's an individual known as philanthropist, right, because they give money away. But his main job is to be speculating. So he has this double speculate and I help the poor type of thing, right? But the idea is to see exactly what he does.
To give and take.
Well, it depends. It helps, maybe.
But, like, and when you say he speculates on a currency, like the lira, like, I don't understand how...
Well, you can...
You just dump it, you buy it, and then dump it? And
If you create a frenzy around something, let's say around the lira, so you buy a lira, and you create a frenzy around the lira, so people will buy, or just the value of the lira goes up because it's the buzz. Yeah. But then if you pull out, and that's probably what happened, then the value went down, and the Italian government had to inject around $50 billion of their own reserves to try to save their currency.
But I think to leave it down something like $200 billion.
He managed to leverage, it says 1.2 trillion. That's 1.2 trillion. Yeah. So 1,200 billion. A lot. That's sick. But you need. That's something you can do with a lot of money. And when you start dumping, well, it can hurt. It can destroy a nation. So Italy managed to save it with a lot of investment. But he did the same to Malaysia. And to Southeast Asia in general, speculating on different currencies like in Vietnam or Myanmar. But then different things happen. I'm gonna talk about it a bit more. Okay. I think the question we should just maybe discuss a bit about that. But what he's stating as a let's say a moral level. Right, what we just read, you know, maybe some people would apply that to other domains, to daily lives, right? Saying, well, if I start caring about everything, about the poor, about the this, about the that, I'm not thinking about myself anymore, or I'm not gonna be able to get ahead, right? Have people experienced that, or?
I had a conversation
like that today. So there's, I guess it's maybe more in terms of a crisis, but sometimes you're caught with, or you think you have some very hard choice to do between, let's say, helping other people or helping yourself. Okay, now the Germany could say, well, you know, it's not, you know, things are insane, but if you're in the economy and if you're called a philanthropist, also considered as a philanthropist by society, it would be interesting to see why. Because Soros is involved. He's involved in four things that you could call is philanthropic interest.
Like non-profit organizations.
Yeah. I'm going to write them down.
Charitable?
Charitable, yeah. Like, I raise funds and I give funds for projects. I'm going to write them down and we'll see what you guys think. Okay, in Indonesia, we have, drug legalization. You have the idea, we can discuss about that, but the idea of an open society. And
is that like, what is it? Sexually?
No, like transparency.
It's linked with this, right? Think about
Democratic Party.
Yeah, that he's a big fun giver. Well, he raises it too, but he doesn't knock at people's door at the chocolate bar.
More encouragement, Democratic Party.
All right, so when we talk about open society, there's a couple of quotes maybe you can look at. Just to illustrate a bit. There you go. There are two. Page 9. There is one by Soros and the one by Tony Blair, which I think should suffice for now. And then we can elaborate. But page 9, it says, not philanthropy, misanthropy. Here?
Oh, yeah.
So he's commenting on one of his funds, which is the Open Society Fund. I'm sorry, Noah. The other column beside, where it says democracy and open society. Someone want to read? Very short.
What page? Oh,
excusez, page 9? En bas, la première colonne.
This is in the middle of the...
In the middle there?
Yeah, democracy and open society.
Oh, okay.
Someone want to read it?
Democracy and open society cannot be imposed from the outside because the principle of sovereignty stands in the way of outside interference. Admittedly, it is difficult to interfere with the internal affairs of sovereign countries, but it's important to face up to the problem.
Okay, so he says that. Okay, nothing big. And then page 10. We see the paragraph that starts with Blair. That's Tony Blair talking about the Extractive Industry Transparency Institute. Right, so they're pushing for what's called transparency, quote unquote, of governments. So Blair says something there. Someone want to read?
Yeah.
No? It says for the first time.
Blair explicitly stated,
yeah.
This one?
Yeah.
Blair explicitly stated his vision for such international institution in a speech before the UN World Summit in September 2005. For the first time at this summit, we are agreed that states do not have the right to do what they will within their own borders, but that we, in the name of humanity, have a common duty to protect people where their own governments will not.
Okay, this is better illustrated when you think about, as I said at the beginning, when I talked about Michael Ignatieff, and these people, there is now, there's a tendency, and that's also what Helga Zeppelarusch warned after the victory of the Irish vote against the Lisbon Treaty. She said that now the next phase will be an attempt to, through humanitarian aid, to intervene in other nations and to create a regime change through not necessarily military means, but bureaucratic means or political pressure or whatnot. So, and this idea of transparency, which also is
people have, might have heard about things like Transparency International and stuff like that. Transparency. Soros was also a big player in these quote-unquote orange, pink-purple revolution in Eastern Europe recently, about a year or two ago, like in Ukraine, right, when there was this this rebellion against the communist system that was still, you know, squashing people's will for freedom. So then Soros would go there with the IMF and the World Bank and say, "Oh, hey, you're free now. You got the democratic economic system, which is, you know, IMF conditionalities, which is the same system that I guess the Western world is suffering from. It's not communism, but it's a different thing." Okay, well, so that, and that's pretty much it, right? There's no thing about giving money to children in Africa or something. That's his way. That's what makes him a philanthropist.
People have any problem with that?
Philanthropy. I like human beings. That's what it says, right?
Is that the meaning of the word?
Yeah. Yes. Like, feel like I love what I like. And anthropology. Human beings. Like philosophy, like I like, I like ideas or something.
Filio.
Filio in Latin.
So people, what do people think?
Loves people so much that they should be able to pull the plug.
To what?
Pull the plug.
Yeah, yeah.
He has to reason, you know.
Usually a philanthropist, like, you give money to, I don't know, finding a cure to cancer.
Or helping the poor, right? Bringing food. and don't be fooled. And when I say drug utilization, so yes, there's this argument about medical drugs, but if you see his Soros activities in Colombia, he's not talking about pot. He says, and that's something that we've seen also in Canada. The reason why I'm bringing those up is that When I meet people in the street, you know, maybe an old grandmother of 86 years old will hear those terms and go, "Oh my God, it's so bad." But I don't see that in general. I see there's a certain acceptance of those things as being, I don't know if it's philanthropist, but to be it's like a caritative move.
Yeah, because
or
you can't say, like, okay, you're for euthanasia or you want legalized drugs. Debatable, you can't say this is immoral. Because a lot of people can say it's a good thing to want to.
It's a live debate.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's exactly.
Well,
you can't say that this person is immoral because of it. I understand what you mean. But at the same time, you won't have, like, today, if you talk about this is the reason why this guy, he's giving his money away to encourage this.
Uh-huh.
You can't say that that makes him a bad person. Which is weird, because when you look at open society and transparency, you look at the guy and where he puts his money, or, you know, he puts it in these Caribbean islands, and he doesn't pay taxes, or almost doesn't, so he's requesting transparency to countries when he's not even transparent.
Yeah.
Himself, so anyway.
Yeah, just so people know, like, hedge funds?
The question is, can he gain anything by investing in this?
Yeah, maybe. Can he gain something?
But I think what you're saying is just, I mean, like, if you just consider how many people's lives are ruined every year by, like, crack addiction and
there's a good quote on that.
I mean,
there's a sick
that's,
quote.
That's, you know,
That's what's so weird. But I understand, like, I'm not for legalization, personally, I'm not for legalization of drugs. But I'm saying, like, if you have a discussion.
Well, let's see, because. Let's see what he says about that, right? Okay, I'll just listen. It's page 7 on top to the left. Page 7 on top to the left. About the war on drugs, right? Because the argument is to say, well, the war on drugs cannot be won. It's too messy. We cannot win it. Therefore, then he says, the war on drugs was doing more harm than the drugs themselves. Drugs kill a few people, incapacitate many more, and give parents sleepless nights. So that's what drugs do. It's not that big of a deal.
It's interesting because I find it's in perfect vein in terms of the context and the kind of mentality again. For me, when we look at these kind of guys, you say, oh, look at him, he worked so hard in his entire life and he built something up, and really he's just another drug dealer, he's just another mafioso, because this is that same kind of mentality. Well, you know what? It's that morose objectivity that allows you to, you know, get to your goal, which you can paint this sort of authentic and nice, like, euthanasia. Yeah, well, you know what, if their life isn't worth living, pull the plug. Drug legalization, well, that's impossible to apply. So you can really organize. But at the end of the day, it's just a way of pushing something that makes you money at the end of the day, or keeps you in power.
Mm-hmm. Well,
society transparency.
I don't know. I think that fighting for the legalization of drugs is quite different than dealing with. So I don't think that fighting for legalization of drugs makes him a drug dealer.
No, that's not what I meant. I meant that idea where...
You did say drug dealer.
Yeah, in the sense that the same thing that he's like a speculator, it's just his job. You know, another person would do it. It's just a way for you to make money. It's not the fact that he's necessarily a drug dealer because he wants to legalize drugs. It's the fact that, no, it's just another job. It's not the fact, because when you look at a drug dealer, I made this point the other day, when you look at a drug dealer or mafioso, they're not particularly intelligent or cunning people with, you know, who are really cultured. They're people who found a way to make money and stick to that because it works and do whatever it takes in order to keep that way of life.
Have you ever noticed mafia or drug dealers?
Yes.
Many times. Well, okay, I'm asking a question. What would you...
I've had a friend who's murdered.
What would you say to someone who says that the war on cocaine should be stopped because it destroys the environment?
The war on cocaine destroys the environment?
Yeah.
The
war on drugs, and let's say Colombia, right, cocaine. So it says, let's stop the war because it destroys the environment.
Well,
how is it doing that, though?
It's a joke.
So if you eradicate the field?
Yeah, the
joke. I can understand why fight for stopping this so-called war on drugs.
Yeah, definitely.
It is wasteful. It is stupid. I don't think it really attacks the problem.
During Clinton years in the U.S., he invested in to stop drugs and mafias in the U.S. However, the money he put in never really ended up going actually to stop the drugs. It only encouraged.
Well, yeah, but that's something else. I mean, that there's money for the war on drugs would go someplace else, but. The question that these guys are asking is what he's saying, right? Same thing in Canada when they had, I think about 2 years ago, there were some senatorial committee created for that. And that's what Mr. Pierre Nolin, that's what we're saying. First and foremost, war on drugs cannot be won. So instead of like losing time, because it's not like they fought war on drugs anyway, maybe in the 70s, but money being put towards war on drugs.
I don't think so. I mean, I think that the no tolerance in the United States during the 80s is probably the height of the war on drugs. The problem.
Yeah, but there's a
huge problem with that particular activity. But I mean, so I think you can be for drug legalization and still be, you know, for a proper
economy. Yes, but
See, I think there's.
But when you say something like, you should stop chopping down, you should stop the war on drugs because it hurts the environment, there's a certain irony there. Because
that's what the coca leaf producers in Bolivia,
yeah,
who are the group financed by Soros.
Yeah.
That's one thing that they were saying.
Finance. Well, see, then he is a drug dealer. It's a different store. Don't you think?
Well,
he's not trying to deal with the situation in a different way. You know, today drugs are being fought against in a very police state kind of way, and I would say that it has been building since the 70s, and at least reached a peak in the 80s, if not has gone even crazier in terms of the money that's poured in and the police positions that are created to fight narcotics. I think that there's got to be a more efficient way to do
But
the question to me is, like, is he for the legalization of drugs because he wants to deal with the drug problem, which is a real problem, or is he for the legalization of drugs because then it makes it more easily for him to move cocaine?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, there's one thing he did in Oregon, which was to pass a law for medical purpose, right? That's usually the argument, like marijuana or whatever. But the problem is that people had to intervene at a certain point because they had to stop the legalization of what's called Schedule 1 narcotics. And I forgot exactly why, but they classified in schedule, I don't know, is a 1, 2, 3, and the ones are the drugs that are not used in medicine, like there's no purpose for them, and that are, you know, harmful. So heroin, I think there was also cannabis, like some hard, a couple of hard drugs, and the Soros drive was for that, was to get all the drugs, right? But that's the thing, right? That's why I'm putting all those things, because he asked, well, what's his aim? What is he actually trying to accomplish? Because, I mean, we could be talking about those things for, just these two, for example, for a very long time tonight. Because it's in there, and I think it should also be considered that since it is in our society, at a certain point it wasn't as big of a subject, but today it is, and this is exactly how it came about. But we're trying to figure out a guy who's owning billions of dollars and is actually using them as a tool, right? To bring the money in certain places to create certain effect. So maybe if we look at these things, not from each, right, like in the moral class, right, those for against, for divide and discuss, but to see that as a whole, to try to look at why would someone like Soros, who, I mean, he has so much money, why does he care about those things? Why these things per se? Why euthanasia? Why drug legalization, with direct involvement against the Colombian government, right? Saying the government. The Colombian government, you are the ones breaking human rights, while narco-terrorists, having a piece of land as big as Switzerland, are taking terrorists like every day, killing people. So yes, you said, well, what's this problem? And this question also with transparency, right? What are they exactly asking to other nations to do? And why the hell does he finance the Democratic Party? Why does he finance why is his movement, MoveOn.org, his movement, because he's the main financer, right? What are they doing now, and why are they doing it? That's going to be the other thing we're going to talk about. So looking at that as a whole, and say, well, what's going on, or who does really profit from those things? Because again, right, for transparency, for example, this idea of open society, when he says in his quote that the first thing that blocks that transparency is sovereignty, right? and then talks about, and then you have this Blair quote saying, well, gay nations cannot do what they want anymore, and Blair being one of the big maker of the Iraq war, right? He said, well, they have a certain agenda. And it's important, I think it's important, especially for the fourth part, because what LaRouche wants to do now, and he knows there's a certain support for that, but we need the American government or American people to join this bloc of four nations, to be able to then have the proper dialogue throughout the world and to force this change. The same way, for example, that the experiments of Benjamin Franklin on electricity, when they occurred in Europe, people really quickly stopped caring about Voltaire and Euler and Maupertuis and all these guys that were attacking, for example, the ideas of the American Revolution. So if we're able to get those nations for a new financial system, or just to discuss about it, because we know that they're not quite clear on what they really need, you can actually change the world very quickly. We can have nations going forward and saying, okay, well, let's reorganize this whole thing, right? So if the U.S. election becomes a mess, well, it's a bit in our responsibility to try to solve things up. From here or from there, we can still go, but there's a role that we have to give to Canada in order to prevent the U.S. from going crazy, and instead going towards LaRouche's economic plan. Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, there's gonna be another dossier after this one. That's what they announced today. It's gonna be on Al Gore. So a lot of fun. A lot of fun, but that's something else. Is there anything I should discuss? No.
I have a question.
Uh-huh.
Well, I was just wondering about the Soros guy. Like, aren't there many people like him? Or just maybe, why is there such an emphasis on him in particular? And mm-hmm. what is it that he's doing which is so different than any other speculator?
You know,
and why is it written on the cover?
Do you
read the cover?
Your enemy, George Soros.
Then it says LaRouche Pact.
Dossier on the man destroying the Democratic Party.
Yeah, what's up with that?
Well, yeah, that's a bit what I want to get into. But if you keep in mind what I just said about the necessity of having the U.S. to join this bloc of nations. I remember. LaRouche said when Kerry was running, John Kerry, he said that the simple fact that Kerry would win, whether he sucks or not, would change the world, because the whole world would go, no more George Bush, and then really the relationship that people had with the United States would start to change. People would finally go there and say, hey, we have an opening. There's a new guy, and he looks okay. He's a Democrat. Democrats are not bad. So, and as maybe people might not know well, but LaRouche has been very critical of the role of Barack Obama being completely an agent, willing or not, of the British Empire, meaning that. And that's why, as we can discuss at the end, but what's happening now in the election is the same event that was happening in 1932, right? We put in the document the article, that's page 18, which explains how FDR managed to keep the candidacy for the Democratic Party president, candidate for the presidency, against intervention from the outside. And that's important because maybe we can do that some other day. But if you go through it, you see that even if you're damn popular, there's nothing set, right? And even in his time, it was even harder because he needed 60% approval at the convention. So there's a lot of fights. There was a lot of fights happening. But there was an intervention because the oligarchy, or the British oligarchy, let's call them that way, knowing their history, they know what potential the United States have in order to change the world. So if you have a so-so guy at the presidency, like let's say Clinton would be a so-so person, things could change rather dramatically, and people could actually talk about things that people would not dream of. So our role as citizens of the world will be to prevent the Democratic Party from collapsing, the U.S. Democratic Party from collapsing. That's why I brought, to see Soros as a pig, it's not that hard. It's easy when you go through, and there's, as they said at the beginning, right, the best way is just to quote the guy. It's very, very nasty.
But those are things that are relating to events.
Yeah.
Okay.
That there's other people. You saying that there are other people like him?
No, I'm just saying, what specifically is that referring to, controller of the Democratic Party? I have two questions. That, how is George Soros controlling the Democratic Party?
Mm-hmm.
And how is he linked to the British Empire? That's like what I keep hearing all the time. This is
mm-hmm.
a British operation.
Mm-hmm.
Say a bit more on how we know that.
Yeah, I'll say more on that. Just no, that's the article. Well, look, what we're seeing right now, and I think it's important. In the election, we've seen Hillary Clinton, who actually decided to wage a fight for the forgotten majority. Not that she was perfect, that's not what I'm saying, but there was a change in the election when she and probably her group with her decided to go for what LaRouche was talking about. Go reach the poor. You need those guys to vote. Don't just let them and say, well, they don't vote anyway, and we're going to go talk with the rich, the dentist or the accountant, whatever. So she, and through our intervention, she decided to wage a campaign for the forgotten majority. The same thing that Roosevelt would have done, except, well, not as good. There's still a lot of things that can be brought up. And there was an intervention coming from the outside and from within the democratic institutions, coming from people like Howard Dean. People remember maybe he ran in 2004. He's the head of the DNC. Also people like Nancy Pelosi, who is the leader of the majority in the Congress, in order to prevent Hillary from becoming the candidate, and using a lot of sophistry, which is, for example, they were saying that she can't win, she's not going to have enough votes, and even there was even a shift, right? Like Nancy Pelosi first admitted that she first said that what would decide of the candidate would be the superdelegates. Because in the U.S. you have two things, right? They have delegates, which are earned through your campaigning in different states. And you have the superdelegates, which are actually named by the party. And it's through the superdelegate on the first turn, the first vote to the convention, you can vote for whoever. They have no allegiance. But then Dean Pelosi and others would force these superdelegates to actually take a stand. Which has nothing to do with anything. That's pure blackmailing. And at a certain point, there was even a shift. So Nancy Pelosi shifted. And she was then talking about the popular vote as being the key. And there was an attack made by this movement, MoveOn.org. That's when we get into the Soros part, where Soros is the main funder of that group since at least 1998. And MoveOn.org, just to give you an idea, this was created during Clinton, during the Monica Lewinsky trial, which is a big thing to break an attempt by Clinton, who had brought up the idea of a new financial system, and he was discussing with people throughout the world for a new financial system. So that was big, and he was thrown this Monica Lewinsky in his legs, you know, impeachment and whatever. So then there were some people in Silicon Valley who created a movement basically saying, censor Clinton and move on. Saying, this big story, you know, let's just impeach the guy and let's move on to other things. Right? To try to, a way to accelerate the process and to get also people that were, I guess, a bit pissed off around, maybe around the mediatic frenzy, right? Clinton and all the news and everywhere. So they say, okay, let's censor Clinton, put him out of work, and let's move on. And obviously, they had this, you know, they had different issues about the poor, about the family, about taxation and everything. And it's generally a movement which is pretty, it's funny because it's, well, we can talk about that some other time. But, when you look at the role of Soros, right, not just, well, first you get this thing with Move On, which is created against the Clinton group, okay, and it's important to know that the Clinton have a certain relationship with LaRouche, so they have a so-so understanding of what he's saying. They're not that great of a deal, but they're there and they can actually do something, as I was saying, that would get people out of this mess. But then you have Soros, and there's others, like we talked about, like Felix Rohatyn as well. But for now, we get this Soros guy who has a member or a big member of the Democratic Party, has endorsed Obama, not just since the election, but even before that. And Obama, and that's what they brought up in the document, that there were many meetings, actually, with Soros and Obama when Obama was running for Senate. Because I think it was, he was a senator for just one term, right? And then he became, I think Obama was there. I think he did only one term, which is 6 years. I have to check this, but he moved pretty quick to fame, and being brought up as the, you know, the progressive candidate. No, you're black and you're young, so it's progressive, right? It's change, big change. But there are two things that when you look, and that's why I brought these things as well, because I think we have to be careful when we say, like, someone is a British agent. That, yes, you can look at who gave him his start when you look at Edmond de Rothschild's family, right? When you look at these imperial Londonian financiers who've been around for many, many generations. And you look also at different of his funds, where you even see the Queen of England, for example, being one of the main investors in one of his funds. That was at the beginning when you see the pictures right there. Right, and different important events, like his presence on the Queen's boat Britannia. That was in the 1990s, I think. And the Soros was the owner of the, well, not the owner, but the director, I guess, of the Quantum Fund, which is a fund where the Queen invests enormously. But that I say, that's not a proof of much, right? She has money there. Okay. But then, in order to understand Soros' role, it's important to keep in mind the whole strategic situation. And what makes an empire win? Is it just that they're all over the place and they have a lot of money and they make deals together and they always manage to somehow they always win, they always play, they fool us all the time and we just fall for it? Is it just that? Or there's actually something that actually there's a bit, maybe there's a bit of George Soros in all of us. Right? That maybe that morality can at a certain point become a luxury for a lot of people. You know, we gotta fight to make ends meet, you know. We hear it all the time, right? And why, when you have a sociopath like Soros, it becomes it's a potential British agent for the British, who then says, well, there's a certain fund, a certain sum of money, here's even some more from the Queen. We create an image around you of, well, this philanthropist, and who is so far ahead, socially speaking, that he's not only able to talk about it, but he's actually going to fund all these changes. Also fund a guy like Obama, who has actually been rejecting any type of real solution, or any type of real role, a real presidential role that he should assume. If you're in such a crisis and you actually are becoming almost more right-wing than George Bush with your position on Israel, your position on the economy, saying, oh, price of oil is going to keep going up and there's nothing I can do, can give some tax incentives. I mean, we're assisting at a collapse of the society. Our movement had an impact on the Democratic Party on this question on the side of the Clinton group. And now we're seeing, because Obama is failing his role, Democrats are seeing that too, and they say, oh my God, what do we do? So now, as was reported today, we had, for example, we were at the Seattle Democratic Convention. And what you meet there are Democrats who endorse Clinton, and she gives an example of this lady, and she's part of a group called PUMA, and it actually means Party Unity My Ass, right? So she's a Clinton supporter, and she was a supporter because of because Hillary was a woman, basically. But this time, thanks. It's, all right.
You touch your glass.
Thanks for being moral. Okay, but this lady who was supporting Clinton for, you know, feministic issues, she actually stopped at her table and she grabbed the pamphlet because she actually understands that there's a problem with the Democratic Party. And she is now, from the report we have there, has been organizing around this Soros thing. Right? So then, because you want this guy to be the cockroach who's being spotlighted, right? And there's also another example of a guy named Larry Chun, who's a former CIA officer, who wrote an article called Hitler and the New Democratic Party, where there's a part where he goes into stuff that we've published around Soros. Right, his link as a Hungarian
that's
Jew.
That's a new book?
That's an article.
New?
Yeah, Larry John. So if Soros, through MoveOn.org, through also different of his minions like Howard Dean, he's been a complete sham since 2004 when he starts screaming on the mic. People don't remember that, but it's so funny when you hear, it's like, he lost, in 2004, he lost, I think, the second state to John Kerry. I forgot which it was. And he takes the mic and he starts yelling like a wrestler. We're going to take back the next state. We're going to win. Woo! Right? And but he completely discredited himself throughout the world. Right? People saw him. Howard Dean, he was one of the favorites at the beginning. $40 million. MoveOn.org is backing him up, so he got all these millions from internet.
Oh, that's the link between Pillars and Kings.
Yeah. MoveOn.org is used, not that they do much like physically, but that's like a some sort of popular think tank. Who
propaganda?
Will... Huh?
Propaganda? Or what?
Yeah, they shape popular opinion. That's why people in the U.S. or here would say, Clinton, she's already losing. She can't win. She can't have enough votes. While the reality and the truth of it is that candidacy is decided at the convention, not after the primary, at the convention, just 2 months after, where there's debates, right? Democratic, we talk, we exchange. So people were completely, people were lied to. Howard Dean did the same. He said, everyone has to, every superdelegate, right, these so-called, they can vote for whoever, they have to take a stand on June 3rd. Why? The convention is in August. And he keeps bringing it up. Same thing also with, that's something else, but. So you have this Democratic Party who is self-destroying, who's about to go kaput. And LaRouche, when he looks at that, he says, well, look, Obama is going to be thrown in the garbage. He's there to destroy the Democratic Party. And Obama would actually lose. He would even lose against McCain because there are some scandals that are erupting on Obama, and they're erupting for certain reasons that he can go down. Now that Clinton is out of the picture, supposedly, now they're going to go after Obama and sink Obama with his link with the different mafiosi in Chicago, people in Great Britain, all these scandals about the Reverend Wright. People have heard about that, right? This black, racist reverend.
That was from the beginning? He was his uncle?
This reverend is like a crazy uncle for me.
Oh.
But he's been at this church for like 17 years, and the black reverend is a racist black preacher. So preaching against white and against union, right? But Obama, the problem with Obama is that he did not, instead of saying, yeah, this guy is crazy, I know, believe me, he says, oh, you know, he's like my crazy uncle, ha ha ha. Right? But people will say, oh, you're crazy. If you do that, he's, according to LaRouche, this guy's going to go down, and that's why we're going to push a dossier on Al Gore. Al Gore right now is in trying to be how do you call that? The new candidate.
Cinderella story coming out of nowhere.
Yeah, coming out of nowhere and say, I have the solution to your dilemma, me.
So I heard that this kind of thing happened after the war, or when
what?
You had a delegate that was that at a certain point become unpopular, so they replaced him with another delegate that didn't have any of the votes or something. It was just the chosen of the Democratic
Party. Like in the article in 1932, they showed that in 1924 there was a third guy who was brought in because you have rounds. So after I think like four rounds, if you don't have a winner, then there's the option for a third or even a fourth guy. So Al Gore, Michael Bloomberg, whoever, you name it. But a guy that would be the concession candidate? Yeah, concession candidate, I guess. But the
consolation. Consolation.
No, like when you make a concession.
No Obama for you. We give you Al Gore.
Second prize.
Okay, but that's, I mean, Gore is another story. But the people we're dealing with when we talk about this British Empire, that they also, I think one of the reasons why they can be efficient, why someone like Soros, why a tool of the British Empire would find themselves financing the Democratic Party like hell, is because they know that right now the time is ripe for enormous changes. I mean, we already see, right, with the food crisis, we have nations that decided to go openly against the WTO, even laughing at it. You have people that says, okay, well, this is enough. We've got to change the way things are doing. You have other nations, maybe not for just moralistic reasons, but are looking toward Africa as a place for development. That these guys require the infrastructure that they never had, right, which is not...
Yeah, I don't believe in morals when we talk about Africa, you know.
Well, yeah, but there's a change. There's a change in saying we're not going to loot those guys. We're going to actually give them the technology. We're going to have a partnership.
Country, it's the richest continent on Earth. I mean.
No, but see, look at the difference, though. Look at the colonial globalization type of approach, and look at people that says, "Hey, we're going to give you thousands and thousands of railroads or infrastructure of miles, thousands of miles of railroads, for example."
Do you think that cheap labor in China is actually some kind of advanced slavery? I think it's the same thing if we talk about investment in
No, no. I'm saying that there are, not saying that everything is nice now. I'm saying that there's an attempt.
They have good intentions.
Well, there's an intention to say we're going to actually rebuild Africa. They don't say we're going to loot the shit out of you, like what the Europeans has been doing, you see. If you bring technology, if you bring energy, if you bring food production, if you do what, if you help the development of these regions, something which didn't happen. What I'm saying is that there's a break in the actual, the imperial dynamic that I've defined in the beginning, right? And if you're in an imperial dynamic, you're a forced act, whether like a colony or like an empire, or you can go a third way, which will break this dynamic, which is to go for what LaRouche calls, which is go back to the principle of the Treaty of Westphalia, go back to the idea of the advantage of the other, have a dialogue with one of the major nations in the world, and make sure you have a 50-year project on the table, not based on a cheesy understanding of let's all be friends and have a fruit punch together, but people that understand what nation states mean and why, you know, why is it that people like Soros would actually attack it through like the Open Society, for example, or actually attacking the sovereignty of the United States through the Democratic Party and actually making it collapse during the election. That's why I emphasize that, because we're not going to be able to understand the so-called British Empire if we just try to look at the connect the dots type of thing, right? Like if the Soros has a second nephew who's actually British or something. But we have to look at it from the standpoint of a dynamic. We did this video, for example, called Firewall, some people have seen, where we try to identify this dynamic of different types of actions from the British Empire at the time that it was the superpower and no one would contest that because it was in your face, versus the American system, right? And there's going to be another documentary coming out, specifically more on the last article on the FDR, the FDR fight around the convention, but also decades before in Germany, and how this fight around the American system versus the British system is operating. But when we organize people around that, the it's important to keep those things in mind, is that the question of morality or immorality sometimes can be taken a bit too lightly, right? But we should see this question of economic development, of the human development from a very rigorous standpoint and be able to identify exactly what are the what is it that we talk about when we talk about economic value, right? Because a lot of people would say, well, Soros knows about economic value, right? He makes a killing in matters of weeks. Or to look at it from a very different standpoint, which is to have a human action which can actually improve the development of each individual in that same society thanks to a discoveries or the application of a discovery to elevate people out of their misery, right? And that's the thing, right? There's also, people can have a sense a bit of the dynamic that we're talking about with this food policy paper that we put together, where you'll see a lot of these bigger projects that we're talking about and how you can go about from really feeding people and feeding the people that are not yet born. So that's a bit what I want to...
The last couple of days ago when I was on the street, and maybe you can go through this, but I was basically going through in a briefing with somebody how we were going to move to save the Democratic Party from being manipulated and destroyed from within. I went through trying to get the briefing to a more optimistic standpoint. I was developing how the crisis was creating an environment, going through Russia coming out to, inviting India into the Shanghai Cooperation Organization with China. And I went through Argentina. And the woman kind of freaked out to me. She said, how can you be for democracy, trying to save the Democratic Party when these are the most undemocratic nations in the world? They're they're totally authoritarian, and she was coming out with every single thing. And kind of stormed off before we actually discussed it a little bit more. And so, Soros is for, transparency, the Democratic Party, and...
He's democratic?
Yeah. Freedom.
He likes parties.
Soros is used as pretext, for all sorts of, regime changes in Iraq war. So I was hoping maybe you could go through maybe what it is about democracy that this lady was thinking about. Why she thinks these nations are being authoritarian and anti-democracy?
Well, see, when we talk about an economic collapse or the collapse of civilization, there must be something wrong that the nations have done. I think that's what we should look at, because people will tend to, people have a bunch of stereotypes about the Russians, the Chinese, the Italians, right?
About everybody.
Yeah. And, when Canadians say, that these nations are not democratic, well, I can look at Canada and say, well, that's not a democratic nation. You can talk about whatever you want, as long as it's unimportant, right? I think people are afraid of a dialogue. Well, people don't know anymore what we mean by a dialogue, right? We're not. Every time a dialogue of culture functions, is that because we went at the root of what is it that makes us human, which is the only thing that we have in common, really. If you talk with people in Asia, and LaRouche said that in his book Earth Next 50 Years, says that actually we don't really know that much about Asia, and that's a problem. You want to know as much as you can, so you want to go talk with them. Instead of reading the New York Times about the Chinese or the Economist, right? I mean, who in Canada or in the United States really have a conception of China before communist regime? Right? Oh yeah, in 5000 BC they were an empire, and now they're communist. Right? That's not knowing history. So my standpoint, instead of saying I know everything about China because you say, well, let's talk and let's have this dialogue, which then you make a serious dialogue about the future of your society. It's people don't necessarily know what they're talking about, so that's why.
Yeah,
with democracy. I mean, democracy is can be good or bad if you just say, and if you talk about the hockey, right, when the season is over and you say, well, talking about hockey, well, yeah, you're allowed to, and free speech, right on, but doesn't put food on the table. You know, hockey players are not really concerned about the economic crisis, to tell you the truth. And also, Canadians should take that idea out of their mind that the Democratic Party means good. I get that all the time. You say LaRouche is in the Democratic Party. Oh, okay, that's good. Is he Republican? Yeah, you have different, yeah, where people think about Clinton or they think about JFK and that say, well, that's good, but that doesn't tell you what's going on. That's when you want to get people, especially as, the United States have two neighbors, basically, and we're one of them. There's no way we can, say, subtract ourselves saying, well, whatever happens over there is none of our business. Well, I'm okay with this idea of the Democratic Party, that it's JFK and it's Clinton playing saxophone and stuff like that. Right? That's not rigorous. And we're not in a position where we can be too sloppy about all those things.
Also, I wanted to mention, like, people also, when they have these kind of arguments, also they forget to put themselves in the picture. Like, cause if you remember, like, when you're talking about the Democratic Party, like, what created it, or, you know, what it formed of. Like, before Roosevelt, I mean, the Democratic Party was the Ku Klux Party.
Mm-hmm.
It was the slaveholder party. But the good party in the 19th century was the Republican Party. Lincoln. But then he got, you know, the president got assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
Taken over. And, yeah, it got taken over by the Wall Street Club. And then...
Mm-hmm. That's the thing with organizing. When you organize the population, or if you go into political parties and you try to bring politics, then you see what's the response. And just by that, I can say that most parties are suffering from a tremendous lack of knowledge, of want, of having a real dialogue, right? Now you have these. Political parties are raising funds through, having a golf game or a barbecue. They're not at the table outside. And I would dream of having the liberal. You go out and organize and see the liberal party outside the table. Wow, that would be a revolution. But you do that twice a year in school. Like, you know, they have the university group of Parti Québécois, and they do a table, you know, twice during the semester, and that's it. But with everything that's required, right, everything that's required to help societies other than ours and the others, well, this people should be out, you know, all the time. There's so much... there's so much that people are looking towards, but they're like in the loophole. You go work, you go watch TV, the family, and then oil prices go through the roof, and you're like, right? I'll get my, and then you have you're caught up, you're caught. They're caught not knowing what the hell do we do. Well, they're falling. They've fallen in the trap of the media, right? Or maybe people have seen that, but in the Journal de Montréal recently, they make this big story about a group of oil provider, like Outremont, Shell, Esso. So that was a little group around Victoriaville of guys who were actually increasing the price of 1 cent and putting that cent in their pocket. But the price of oil is $1.40, $1.45 or $1.50. Who cares about that cent? But then the Journal de Montréal make it super big. So and then you meet people in the street and they talk about it. Ah, these guys are ripping us off. It's $1.45.
Yeah, but for each cent, the last one, 1 cent per year.
Yeah, but
it's $1.45 is like many cents. Many cents.
You can see it. You can see in the story, though, the way that the media is effective in diverting attention from the core causes and issues. Anything that would actually, that if enough people focus on it, would actually make a change. They're diverting it. You know, you go after a few guys who are making $1 billion in a day, but who have nothing to do with the price of oil.
But it's the same thing with drugs. It's like busting some drug dealer for 1 kilo while, like, you're not paying attention to the ports at all when, like, 100 metric tons
uh-huh.
are coming in every month.
Sure.
It's the same principle. That's what it is. They're busting, the whole thing is they're busting for being a cartel. They're calling each other up and secretly bringing
yeah.
prices when OPEC is admittedly, it's a cartel. The C in OPEC is